Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 8th. Today's session is entitled Poetry and the Bible, Eve. And the presenter today is Kath Schwen. Let's listen in.
Pull away, so maybe what we'll do is actually get started, and then I think people will catch on pretty quickly as they come in. So welcome. Thank you for coming. My name is Kata, and when I'm not here,
I guess whoever's taping this, you could start taping now.
What?
It's Brian.
Oh, it's Brian. Hi, Brian. Everybody could say hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Yeah, we're so glad you're taping. Wonderful. My name is Kata, and when I'm not at Holden, I live in Iowa City, where I just finished getting an MFA at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I'll be teaching at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, next fall, which I'm very excited about.
That sounds tremendous.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. So today, what we're going to be doing is talking a little bit about Eve, it's a very large subject, and so sort of the way we're going to go into it is by reading a little bit from Genesis, brainstorming a little bit about sort of our notions of Eve, and then looking at two poems that both deal with Eve in pretty different ways. The first one we'll look at is by Robert Frost. How many people have read something by Robert? Okay, yes. So it's a little bit more of a traditional in its form and things like that. And the other one is by a contemporary female poet named Jory Graham. And so we'll sort of use both of those poems to see in what ways the poets are sort of supporting our notions of Eve that we get from the Bible, and in what ways they're sort of working against those notions and have tension with them. So that's kind of the framework that we'll be... Does that make sense? Okay, fabulous. So Sarah was going to read for us from Genesis 15 and all the way to the end. Oh, no, I'm sorry. 15 through 3, through all of 3, too. Let's do that. Is that...
Genesis 2...
215 through 324.
The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You may freely eat of every tree in the garden, but of the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall die." Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper as his partner." So out of the ground the Lord God formed every animal of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all cattle and to the birds of the air and to every animal of the field. But for the man there was not found a helper as his partner. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, for out of man this one is taken." Therefore a man leaves his father and his mother and clings to his wife, and they become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Now the serpent was more crafty than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God say, 'You shall not eat from any tree in the garden?'" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die.'" But the serpent said to the woman, "You will not die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will live, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves. They heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden at the time of the evening breeze, and the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. The Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" He said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself." He said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent tricked me, and I ate." The Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you among all animals and among all wild creatures. Upon your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will strike your head, and you will strike his heel." To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And to the man he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree about which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return." The man named his wife Eve, because she was the mother of all living. And the Lord God made garments of skin for the man and for his wife, and clothed them.
Actually, you can stop right there. Thank you so much. That was a lot of beautiful reading. Okay, so let's just kind of make a list about what are, based on this story, what are our notions of Eve? These could be personality-wise, they could be physical, they could be theological. What sorts of things come to mind after reading the story? Who is Eve? It can be really simple or really complex.
Well, she's curious.
Curious, great. What else?
Daring.
Daring, awesome. Find another marker. Daring, what else?
Naive.
In conversation.
Conversationalist?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
She has a conversation.
Yes, okay.
She was made to be a partner.
Made to be a partner. So sort of, she was a second thought in certain ways to be joined to Adam, right? What else?
Well, at that time, she must have had big hips because it was easy for her to give birth.
Okay. Well, I think that's great. I'll put big hips here, but also at this point, I mean, she's the archetype of femininity, right? I mean, she's the only woman that we've got. So anything sort of female, we've got kind of heaped upon her, sort of. And so, what kind of other things are? What are the archetypical feminine qualities? Besides big hips.
Well, and it isn't really truly big hips. It's healthy, flexible tissue, so she can give birth easily.
Birth, right. Great. So she's, what else?
A loving and generous.
Great. What else?
Nurturing, I guess.
Nurturing.
I don't know that it says that exactly.
No. Right, okay. These are sort of, these aren't really in the text. They're more things that are implied because.
Well, submissive then.
Submissive, great. Submissive, soft,
desire,
tender, strong. What?
Desire.
Desire. Say more about that.
Well.
Like she has desire or
she's
what? Desire. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say she desired, she looked at the apple and She desired it.
Okay.
Good thing
so,
to have.
Full of desire, but was in the story, does this desire turn out to be a good thing or bad?
That depends on your interpretation.
No. Okay. I mean, if we're looking just at the text itself, sort of what takes place afterwards, that
your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you.
So the desire turns into that. It becomes, she's full of desire, which is first directed at the apple and then becomes directed at man, right? That sort of transformed. But
she's disobedient.
Disobedience. Great. So that her, within the text itself, it seems very much that her desire provokes disobedience, and thus she gets
banished.
A lot of bad things happen as a result of this. So, but I think what you're saying about which way do you look at it in terms of if it's good or bad, a lot of the poems are going to start thinking about that. But sort of the way we usually read it is that Eve was disobedient, the desire was problematic, a bunch of bad things happened, right? We can sort of all, it's the primary reading usually.
Curse.
Childbearing, right?
Painful childbearing. That, I mean, it's a curse.
It's not a curse. Painful childbirth, and what else? What are the other things?
Well, you know, she shared the apple. I mean, you say she shared. That was a good thing. But
sharing.
You know, we generally think that she just tempted. You know, whether is she sharing or is she tempting?
Yes.
What kind of a man stands by and lets his wife do something like that?
She's practical. It says she sees that the apple's good. She's looking for food. She says, here's some.
She sees, read those three lines. She says it's good for food. And what are the other
delight
two things?
Delight to the eyes.
Delight to the eyes.
And that the tree was to be desired to make one wise.
Okay, so it's, hey, it's practical, it's good food, it looks really pretty, it's sort of an aesthetic value, and hey, wisdom's cool, I want to be smarter, right? So all of those three things.
She got a commitment to education.
What?
She got a commitment to education.
That's right. Okay, we obviously could go on this way for some time, because there's plenty in the story, but I think we've got some of the main things here. Okay, so now.
I bet there was more than one apple involved, because it says, was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. She took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband. I mean, if apples are good, and you know when an apple tree is bearing, it's got lots of apples on it.
Uh-huh.
So that they eat some now.
So more than one apple.
It doesn't say there's only
one. Doesn't say. Okay, so apples, I'll put it. And we might need to share the poem, so if there might not be enough copies. So this poem, and you, because of some photocopying issues, I didn't get to write it on there. This is by Robert Frost. How many people have read this poem before? Anyone? Familiar, Jody?
Probably
at some point, right? Just before we read it, so you know, Robert Frost, it looks like it's in two different stanzas there. It's not actually. It, because of the way it got photocopied, it was on two separate pages, and then the people that did it didn't put it together. So that's not, it should all be in one. Okay. So I'm going to read it. Okay. Never again would birdsong be the same, he would declare, and could himself believe, that the birds there in all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would birdsong be the same, and to do that to birds was why she came. Would someone else be willing to read it just so we can hear it again? Someone? one-fingered grief.
Never again would bird's song be the same, he would declare, and could himself believe that the birds there in all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound. Her tone of meaning, but without the words. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as it may, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now pertained and now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Never again would bird's song be the same. And to do that to birds was why she came.
Thank you. Okay.
So, oh, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to preface this by saying we'll spend some time sort of going through this line by line and stuff like that, but any just sort of initial impressions, things that jump out at you. Hans, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to ask, he would declare and could himself believe, is that Adam? For God?
Okay.
Oh.
Oh. Oh, all clear. Wow, we lucked out. Okay, so Hans went right to it and asked a great question. Who is the speaker of the poem? It could be Adam, right? Any arguments for or against Adam, or for or against God, or for or against somebody else? We can also return to that as we work through it, too.
We don't know who's speaking in Genesis, either.
Okay.
Sort of a narrator.
So it could be sort of an omnipotent narrator. Okay. Okay. Well, let's come back to that, because I think that's a really good question. Any other just initial things people kind of want to bring up?
Well, Eve's had a long-term impact. I mean, she's had a great influence here.
Okay, and how do you know that?
Well, because the bird songs have changed, and they have forever changed. They'll never be the same again.
Yes, and we know that because we get had now persisted in the woods so long, mm-hmm. right? So there's a sense of time, right?
Right?
That this has created change over a period of time.
And
there
was
a
purpose.
Affecting the birds. I see the birds as just a representation of nature and the world.
Okay,
yeah.
of sort of what has been the human imprint
the human.
On nature and how
mm-hmm.
is that affected. Okay, great. What else?
There was purpose.
Purpose.
That's why she came.
Okay. And that last line is incredibly loaded, I think, in a lot of ways. So we're going to get back to that at the end in a variety of ways. But
well,
go ahead.
Just say one. My impression is, but which I'm not really sure about, but
yeah.
It's a very, in my reading of it, it's a very positive and affirming representation of who he is. And,
okay,
that's
why?
That's my reading.
Why?
Because she affected her environment, and I'm reading it in a good way in that regard. That was the sense. Interactive and effective and relational.
Okay.
Those all are good outcomes.
So that there was a positive
creative
outcome
creative.
To her being there, and
yeah.
as evidenced in how she affected the birds.
Well, and that phrase, an eloquence so soft, I mean, that's a very positive, that's not a negative impact.
Okay.
There's eloquence to it.
Though then we get in the next line there, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds, right? Like the eloquence so soft is this, like, kind of beautiful, nice, elegant thing, and then it's undercut a little bit by, well, such a soft tone. I mean, all you could really have an impact on is birds. I mean,
you continue the next
right.
on birds when call or laughter carry the
when call or laughter, right.
I don't take with the emphasis only on birds.
Mm-hmm.
Only when the call or laughter carry it along.
when the caller laughter of her voice, right, carried aloft, was when it had the influence on birds.
Yeah.
Great. And I think that's a great example there of how Robert Frost is being very smart and tricky in his line breaks. So that we get it, first we get the meaning of her tone of meaning, but without the words. Okay, so admittedly an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds, which seems negative until you're absolutely right. We finish the sentence when it turns out, oh no, I didn't quite mean that.
And ironically, now we have that space. That was not intended.
Right, it's not intended.
Exactly.
Yes.
So you're fooling us here.
Yes, yes, very tricky. But no, that's great. I think it's working on sort of both of those levels at once. What a, yeah, Ingrid.
The line breaks, to me, the whole thing is in words, like a bird in flight.
Okay.
Uh-huh. It's that you can almost see the bird wheeling around. The bird, you know, it turns and it turns. It's one direction becomes another, and it's almost embodies the whole set of words and line breaks embodies a bird in flight.
Okay, so you feel so the motion of the line break starts to feel to you sort of like a flight. Great. What's the form of this poem? Does anybody know?
It's a sonnet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this, and we could sort of go through very slowly, and I'm just going to tell you rather than going through all of it, but the rhyme scheme, we get A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. And that is the rhyme scheme for a Shakespearean sonnet. He follows it very carefully, and most of it is in very regular iambic pentameter, which is also called for a Shakespearean sonnet. But a lot of critics have argued that the sort of rhetoric for a Shakespearean sonnet, because of the rhyme scheme, you have three quatrains, okay? Let me just write this, you'll see it better here. Does everybody know what I'm doing when I'm doing this, or no? That the rhymes, that line, the first line rhymes with the third line, and the second, wherever the letters are, those are the rhymes. Is that okay? So with a Shakespearean sonnet, usually what happens is you have these three quatrains, and then this final couplet. And usually, right before the couplet, right here, there's sort of a turn in the rhetoric of the sonnet. If you go back and look, most Shakespearean sonnets kind of do that. Well, they'll be going on in a certain way, and then right at the end, there'll be a turn. So Shakespeare has one, "My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red." It goes on and on in this way, sort of insulting the woman that he loves. And then at the end, it turns and he says, "And yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare." So he's sort of railed on how ugly she is for about 12 lines, and then it flips and he says, "And yet she's awesome." Okay, so that's sort of the rhetoric of the Shakespearean sonnet. A Petrarchian sonnet, the turn in sort of rhetoric comes after the, let's see if I get this right, after the first eight lines. So it's divided into eight and six, an octet and then a sextet. And so a lot of critics have argued that although this follows the rhyme scheme of a Shakespearean sonnet, that rhetorically it follows the nature of a Petrarchan sonnet. And so it's sort of, so you're kind of like, great, who cares? But in the sense where already we're noticing, as Ingrid's saying, with the flight of the bird, and we've already brought out with these line breaks, that there's these turns happening, that this is another way of sort of pulling us in two directions at once. So that if we read a lot of sonnets, your expectation is that you're waiting for the turn to come at the end, and all of a sudden you get this jolt in the middle, and so experientially reading it feels a little bit different. Does that make sense?
Well, he even says, "Be that as may be."
Yes, right. So that's right. Here we're gonna do. We're gonna like do a major turn, and I'm going to signal it by a phrase like that. Okay? Is that... Okay. So, we start out, the title is a quote, right? It's a line. And then we get that he first, calling into question who it is that's speaking. And let's just go through these, the first sort of five lines here. What do people notice? He would declare and could himself believe. Is there anything interesting sort of about that line for people?
It's possible that he would make declarations that he didn't believe.
Awesome. So already we have a division between declaration and belief, right? That you could say something that maybe actually you didn't believe. Okay? So already we're dealing with sort of two kinds of mode of thought.
It makes you wonder, does he wants to believe?
Right. Right. And in this case, he could himself believe, but what are all the other cases where he would declare but couldn't, you know? Anything else about that first line? Or the title?
Well, the title throws the rhyme scheme off.
Okay, because?
The title becomes an integral part of the poem.
Okay, where? Oh, you mean it's as the first?
As the first line.
Okay, right. So we have this very perfectly structured sonnet, but because we're reading the title as the first line of the poem, it throws everything a little bit off. It doesn't feel quite right. Right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, which might be perfect for other reasons.
Yes. Yes.
And how do we know to read that as the first line?
Why do you think? Or we could argue against that it's the first line. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it needs to be the first line.
Yeah, I consider it the first line.
You didn't? Yeah. How, so,
it's just the title.
So what would you? What did you think of him declaring? He would declare.
The birds there and all the garden around from having heard the ailing voice.
Oh,
like a
okay.
Long sentence altogether.
Okay, so you could chop off that.
Yeah.
Is there any argument for why we think that is the first line?
Why the title could be the first line?
No, because it tells your silence scheme out of way.
Okay. Yeah. But you can see how you could read it that way in the sense that. I mean, it could be what comes before, right? I mean, you could read it both ways. Mm-hmm. It's unclear. But if we read it as it's the he that's saying that, whether the he is Adam or God or whatever, the end gets also called into greater question because we get it repeated at the end, the second to last line, never again would birdsong be the same. The question then becomes, is the person who's speaking the poem the same person that said it to begin with, or is he repeating what that speaker had said, or is, you know, how are those lines related? Does that make sense?
Is there an omniscient narrator that's talking about Adam declaring and believing that the birds had added Eve's over sound to their song?
Right, right.
Or just man.
Right, or just man, yep. Okay, well we can come back to that.
How does the poet set the title, I suppose? I mean, because he could have called it Eve.
Right, sure.
Or Birdsong.
Right.
That wouldn't have been as ambiguous then.
Right, right. He could have chosen a differently ambiguous title, but instead he's chosen one that could be part of the poem or could be separate from the poem. It could be included or excluded. So again, you know, it's that shifting. How would it have been different, too, if the title had just been Birdsong Will Never Be the Same?
The would is conditional. And
yes.
The would appears in two different places, in the first line and in the title.
Yep.
Both of those are conditional.
Yep.
So you're on pretty iffy ground here to begin with.
Yes. Awesome. You get would in the title and then would and could in the first line. So already whatever's being declared, it's a little bit uncertain. You know, yes, exactly, shaky ground. Okay, that the birds there in all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her tone of meaning, but without the words. What do you notice about those lines? Anything jump out at you?
tone of meaning. What is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a great phrase.
Are the birds being tempters? Are the birds calling us to some kind of, you know, to get our head into the clouds instead of on Earth?
Okay. So tone of meaning.
Are the birds saying, yes, eat apples and also come fly with us?
Yeah. Right. What is the tone of meaning that's getting impressed on the bird song exactly? Great.
I also like tone because it can also mean like in music.
Yes, great, musical tone. And it also can be related to poetry. We talk about what's the tone of the poem, and as we've already started to discuss going through this, we've kind of been on shaky ground in lots of parts of this poem, and part of it is we get to that last line, and how do we read that? So the tone of meaning comes into play and becomes very important in this poem itself, as well as just in her song.
And it teaches us at the same time that meaning is not necessarily attached to language.
Yes, which actually, that's
say
great.
That again.
What she's saying, meaning is not necessarily attached to language. Mm.
Which?
No, that's many words. And that's kind of what I was thinking of when we're speaking to somebody. You can say some words and they don't hear your words, they hear the tone.
Yeah.
That you're speaking those words in, and it takes on a whole different
completely different meaning. That's absolutely true. And in fact, you guys have hit upon what Robert Frost was really interested in, which was something called sentence sound, which has to do both with tone, but also in terms of, he believed that the way that you organize the words in a sentence, so the rhythm that's created by them, carries a meaning that is above and beyond whatever the content of the words are. And so that sentence sound has to do not only with tone, which has more to do with who's reading it, right? But also with how long are the words? How many syllables do they take? Is this falling into a regular rhythm pattern or is it irregular? All of those things. He believed that there's two layers of meaning there. Yeah, go ahead.
Now, isn't that what any good poet will do? I mean, that's what poetry is, or not.
Yes.
I mean, mm-hmm.
I think absolutely so. I think absolutely so.
It
but I think he was...
Poetry rather than prose.
Yes.
Right. With all these...
Though there are certainly some poets, I think, that adhere to that more than others. Contemporary, more and more as poetry has progressed, I think poets have become interested. Some aren't probably as interested in the music of the language as...
romantic poets are just the best.
Right. Romantics and modern, you know, certainly Frost, Eliot, people like that, very interested in that. But sometimes it's just getting the person to actually spell it out and say what it is that people have been doing for a long time, you know, and that was kind of his... Yes. Okay.
The day-long voice.
What?
The day-long voice has different connotations.
Okay, go ahead.
And somebody called him a conversationalist. So that's the negative stereotype of the woman that she talks too much, right?
Okay, that it's been going on for a day. You shut up, yes.
Voice.
That's great.
She's intruding on mm-hmm. nature in a way that, with that connotation to me.
Great.
I think the narrator is God.
You do? Okay, how come?
Because the sense of time. So much time has passed, and this influence has gone on and on and on.
Okay.
I think God would notice that, not man or Adam.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, so then it...
Also knowing that to do that to the birds is why she came.
Exactly.
God omniscience. Mm-hmm.
Okay, in which case, if it's God speaking, what typically sonnets are... What sort of poem? What's the subject of a sonnet usually?
Love,
right? So we have this sonnet, but it's not immediately apparently a love poem, right? But if it is God speaking, could it be read as a love poem to us? Or some other interpretations of this? Usually I don't like to throw in too much of like the poet's autobiography, but as I was reading some criticism about this, I just thought this was interesting. Frost's wife died in 1938, and this poem was written in 1942, and so a lot of people read this as an elegy to his wife. So that's another version. Mm-hmm. Also, his longtime secretary, who I'm unclear if there was a little romantic side to that. Her name was Kay Morrison, I think. If anybody knows more about Frost, jump in. But she retired, and he read this at her going away deal. So other people thought that he wrote it for her. So now we have, I mean, it's very different, or is it, to have written an elegy for one's wife, to have that sort of be contained and hear that sadness, versus a love poem from God to creation, right? Those are two very different. So that's in the mix. Let's see, let's skip to... admittedly, we talked about this a little bit already. Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. Any other thoughts about those three?
Is it me or... when I read that, I mean, we're reading it as if only birds, this only could have affected birds. Mm-hmm. But the way I first heard it was that, in essence, it could not have not had an influence. It could only have had an influence.
It could only have.
It was so powerful that it inevitably would have influence.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's the way I heard it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see.
Not everything can have an influence on birds.
Right.
Only an eloquence so soft as this, as Eve's voice, could have had an influence on birds. Like, not just anyone can influence birds.
Okay, so again, because of the syntax here, we can either read this as only Eve's eloquent and sort of all-powerful voice could have had an influence over birds, or... Yeah.
Her words are for the birds.
Right, her words are for the birds. Yeah.
No, I think I'm a plain, simple person.
Okay.
Admittedly, an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds when call or laughter carried it aloft. In other words, the birds couldn't hear it because it was so quiet. When she laughed or called and it was louder,
right,
then the birds who were up there could hear it.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I think all of those I think all of those interpretations are there and purposefully there. Because I wouldn't say that with all poets. I think some poets are not so, they're usually as kind of one way, but Frost is.
But that would make the call or laughter, whatever is contained in the meaning of a call or laughter, more important, because those are the things that would reach the bird's ears.
Okay.
They were the things that influenced the birds.
Okay, so sort of the nature of what's contained in those things of having import, right?
Now I'm recalling Frost was quite a naturalist, so I like the idea that it's written after his wife and in memory of his wife or some other love affair, because I can see that he's reliving a walk in the woods or you know, just a natural life, and this person, this woman. You know, so he's reminded of that. The birds remind him of the experiences that they shared.
Right.
When they, for example, walked in the woods.
So that's sort of the love side of things. Yeah. When, you know, someone's not with you anymore and you go for a walk outside and you can hear in the breeze and everywhere their sort of voice. Great.
Or laughter carried it aloft also suggests to me, like, speaking to God, the praises go up, the calls go up.
Great.
To God. That's, I think, the other reason why I keep thinking the narrator is God, is that line as well. God heard it and the birds heard it.
So sort of back in some ways to what Ingrid was saying of, like, what is contained, what would be the things that would go up high that would have that sort of range, and prayer might be another, okay, and then we get this shift. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices crossed had now persisted in the woods so long that probably it never would be lost. Okay, where are we now, just setting-wise, versus where we were, you know, eight lines before? How has the setting shifted?
It's definitely a shift.
Yeah.
They're all past. There and now we're here and now.
Now we're here and now, right? So that was past. But in terms of just the physical, what word is being used for the physical surroundings?
The woods.
The woods instead of?
The garden.
The garden. Okay, so the garden has changed, and it's so slight, like,
it's very slight,
I didn't even catch it the first times, right? But, so there's a sense that, I mean, garden has a different, what's the difference between being in a garden versus being in the woods?
Well,
just in terms of?
One is cultivated and domestic, and the other one is wild.
Wild, yeah. And more, and woods have more danger to them sometimes, you know? They can be beautiful, but they can also be dangerous. And what about, and people notice other things about how things are phrased or what words are sort of used?
Again, the word crossed means some conflict of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Well, even though there's
persistent.
Still, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
There's words in here that are often have negative.
Okay, like it's persisted, crossed,
strong.
Because crossed is very different than they just added to their own and over sound, right? That there's a different sense of
dissonance.
What it is. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
There's more declarative sense here.
Okay.
Even though there's still wood is used one more time, but it's kind of used in a way that is not conditional.
Right.
And,
what
the rest of it is declarative.
What parts feel very declarative? Like, this is somebody who knows what they're talking about and wants to get to the point.
Well, she was there, so.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Be that as it may.
Yeah, be that as may be. Sort of like, I'm going, all of a sudden it seems like we have the voice of somebody who's instructing us, and be that as may be.
Well, it's almost,
blah, blah,
blah. It almost counteracts the subjunctive at the beginning that would and could. Now it's definitive.
She was mm-hmm.
It's no longer
she was in their song.
It's definite.
Yeah. Her voice upon their voices crossed and have persisted in the woods so long.
And then we get that probably it never would be lost, right? We get declarative, 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 that probably it never would be lost, right? We get probably, we get back to the conditional, and you're kind of like, who is this person that's talking that can't seem to decide how sure they are of their own story or his own story? And then we're back to, well, actually, first of all, before we get into the very last parts, I also want to point out, and I'm going to point it out really quickly, because we do have another poem that maybe we could touch on for 5 minutes, that not only in this poem do we have all of the end rhymes at the end of the lines, but also throughout you have all of these internal rhymes. So things that are rhyming in the middles of sentences. So would and could in that first line rhyme with each other, but also we get heard and bird in the second and third lines. Bird rhymes with heard. And we get own and tone. And we get, where else? Be and she in the middle of that one. And in the last four lines, you get woods in the middle rhyming with would, the conditional would, right? So that there starts to be a relationship between those things, and birds gets repeated too. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff in there. So in this poem that's about two kinds of voices or sounds being crossed and being overlaid on one another, you have that those obvious rhymes at the end of the lines, and then you also have the quieter, more subtle rhymes that are carried through sort of in the middle of the lines. So there's also those two sort of different types of musics that are overlaid on one another too. Does that kind of make sense? Or no? You're looking.
Yeah. No, I mean.
It does.
Frost makes frost and sparkle.
Yeah. Amazing. I know.
Did he plan it that way? Was it just flow out?
You know, I don't really know, except to say that I think when that a lot of it is subconscious, but it doesn't mean that it's not very smart. Does that make sense? Like, just because it wasn't planned, just because it was a subconscious choice, there's a lot of wisdom that comes up from the subconscious, and you do things you didn't even plan, but it turns out they were very. Before we, gosh, this poem, there's so many things to talk about. I want to talk about the last line and then just read through this other poem and people can say their thoughts and whatever, because I think it's a very different take. We haven't talked about the rhythm that much, but I want to talk about the rhythm in terms of the last line. So sonnets usually are written in iambic pentameter, which means are people familiar with this sort of a little bit? Yes, somewhat? Okay. Meaning it means an unstressed syllable and then a stressed syllable and then unstressed, stressed, unstressed, stressed, unstressed, stressed. Okay, so the last line. As, tell me your name in the pink shirt. Tell me your name. Yeah.
Sharon.
Sharon mentioned before, she was talking about tone, and tone can be conveyed a lot in terms of which words we choose to stress in a line. So the line...
I just did that in the last line, and I can't get it on the two.
Okay.
But if I go from there, it's... And to do that to birds was why she came.
Right. So it's supposed to, I mean, theoretically, with iambic pentameter, it should be like this. And it's really interesting that these are all single syllable words here. We don't get a single double syllable, which means that any of them could be stressed or not stressed, okay? And think about the different, and he's been not completely perfect about rhythm through the rest. There's been off places. So when we get to the last line, okay, it could be perfect iambic pentameter, or it there could be something screwy about it. But how different is it to say, and to do that to birds was why she came, versus, and to do that to birds was why she came, versus, and to do that to birds was why she came.
Or, and to do that to birds.
To do that to birds, right. Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, if you put the emphasis on she, you're dealing with the relationship between her and Adam, that Adam came for one reason, but she came to be the one to have this influence on birds. There's so many ways that you could do that last sentence, and each one has a completely different theological or aesthetic or whatever influence on the rest of the entire poem, right? In terms of how you go back and read it. Which I just think is... And that's why, I think as you pointed out, just very near the beginning, that, the reading of that last line could be a very positive reading of Eve, or it could be back to some of the negative aspects of Eve. But it all is dependent on where we as readers decide to put the stress. It ultimately comes down to where we are sort of, you know? And in certain ways, no, because we can go back to the poem, and I think there's certain things that we can pull out as... This is a very clear argument that he's making, but to a certain extent, that last line is kind of up to us in certain ways. Any last thoughts on this one before we move on to the next? Okay. So this one, very different, here, by a poet named Jory Graham, who taught at the Iowa Writers Workshop for a long time and now teaches at Harvard. And is known sort of as a very academic-y type poet. And is sometimes given a lot of crap for that. And sometimes it's probably legitimate and sometimes maybe not. But theoretically we're supposed to be done right now, but we started a little bit late. But I understand if any people need to start scooting to lunch. We'll just read through and then people can throw out thoughts. We won't go through it really slowly. Okay, so I watched a snake hard at work in the dry grass behind the house catching flies. It kept on disappearing. And though I know this has something to do with lust, today it seemed to have to do with work. It took it almost half an hour to thread roughly 10 feet of lawn, so slow between the blades you couldn't see it move. I'd watch its path of body in the grass go suddenly invisible, only to reappear a little further on, black knothead up, eyes on a butterfly. This must be perfect progress, where movement appears to be a vanishing, a mending of the visible by the invisible. Just as we stitch the earth, it seems to me, each time we die, going back under, coming back up. It is the simplest stitch, this going where we must, leaving a not unpretty pattern by default, but going out of hunger for small things, flies, words, going because one's body goes. And in this disconcerting creature, a tiny hunger, one that won't even press the dandelions down, retrieves the necessary blue-black dragonfly that has just landed on a pod. All this to say, I'm not afraid of them today or anymore, I think. We are not, were not, ever wrong. Desire is the honest work of the body, its engine, its wind. It too must have its sails, wings in this tiny mouth, valves in the human heart, meanings like sailboats setting out over the mind. Passion is work that retrieves us, lost stitches. It makes a pattern of us. It fastens us to sturdier stuff, no doubt. So thoughts about this one, either in how it relates to the biblical story, how it relates to Frost's poem, just lines that you like?
Bodily knowledge.
Bodily knowledge, yeah. You want to say more about that?
Our lives and the movement of them are probably more holistic than our rational society is. Mm-hmm. And there's a knowledge that all of us are all parts of ourselves and whole persons know that move us along in ways we probably don't even realize or have come to forget about.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Desire is the honest work of the body, mm-hmm. its engine, mm-hmm. its wind.
Mm-hmm. Honest work.
Yeah.
That's great.
Eve was honest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the idea that it was honest work that she was doing.
And she wasn't wrong. We mm-hmm. are not, we're not ever wrong.
Yeah, do you agree? What do you guys think?
Where would we be if we didn't have any desire for passion or food or sex or mm-hmm. or fun?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's she's disagreeing with the story of Genesis, the take on it, the tone of it.
Yes. Absolutely.
She's making a statement here.
Yeah.
I always sort of felt that they were set up. I mean,
Here it is, don't touch it. I mean, how many of you have kids? If you say that to me, you know the first thing they're going to do is touch it.
Yep.
Well, back to Frost, if you say it's God that's declaring and believing, to do that to birds is why she came to, and he put her on the earth.
Exactly.
So,
yep.
He's a bird. There was a purpose
yep.
to her.
Yep.
Things may have not gone quite the way he anticipated.
Right. Yeah, but if to do that to birds was why she came, well, did she get to decide that she was coming on down? I mean, no, well, I think I'll head on down to Earth to do some stuff to birds, you know? Yeah, and also, I mean, just sort of, there's a ton to talk about in this one, too. She also, I think, in some ways, interestingly enough, similar to Frost, this, like, moments like all this to say, it's very much like be that as may be, right? Those sort of turns and uses of I'm not afraid of them today or anymore, I think.
Yeah, she's got
right?
that doubt in there.
Thing. Yes.
Well, what's the them? Who's them?
Who do you think them is?
Snakes.
I love that. Snakes, because that's one of the punishments, right? For the snake, is humans are going to be afraid of you. So she's taken aback, you know, that could be a decision. Like, what a huge thing to say, I'm not going to be afraid of snakes, that in some way that's going back against.
No. Yeah. When I see, well, the title shot is the first line, too. I mean, I am afraid. I mean, I just seeing the title, I don't like to read this. But reading it, it's totally winsome.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Got a new outlook on snakes, maybe.
Maybe.
But if she's not afraid of snakes, does that mean she's not afraid of the devil and all that represents?
Great. I don't know. But you're right. It has all of those implications in it.
I like to think of this at the end. Passion is work that retrieves us. Of course, you can play with the idea of the passion. Us lost stitches. And thinking of God as a being of desire, God is something we don't often do, but that's a big part of what this might be about.
Yep. And I think it actually is a whole another session that we could do on this poem, because she's also connecting passion and lust, and then work gets thrown in there a lot. And what are the, those are big words, and she's complicating them a lot in this in terms of how we've understood it in the relationship to this story. But unfortunately, or fortunately, it's time for lunch. We have to do that honest work of eating. But thank you all for coming and for being so smart.